Welcome back to New Books in American Studies. I'm the co-host of the channel, Lillian Barger. Today, my conversation with Jamin Creed Rowan, Assistant Professor of English and American Studies at Brigham Young University. His book, The Sociable City and American Intellectual Tradition, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press, offers a history of how American intellectuals and planners thought about urban relationships shaping modern cities. He traces how cities' physical landscape changed as ideas about the nature of their social life were reconceived. Beginning with Frederick Law Olson in the 19th century, who expressed anxiety over the erosion of social sympathy, to the Progressive Era's deployment of the family ideal for urban friendships, to mid-century models that saw these relationships as part of and analogous to an ecological system. Along the way, he examines the thought of Jane Addams, W.E.B. Du Bois, the journalist at The New Yorker, Rachel Carson, and Jane Jacobs, and the disruptive force of the urban renewal projects. Rowan provides the reader with a new way to value sociable fellow feelings in the midst of the diversity and rapid changes of today's city. Here's my conversation with Jamin Creed Rowan. Now let me introduce you to the author, Jamin Creed Rowan. Jamin, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts with our audience. Before we get into the book, tell us about yourself, your background, and how you came to write The Sociable City.
Of course. I'm currently an associate professor at Brigham Young University, and I've been teaching here for 7 years. Prior to that, I taught at Wake Forest University for a couple years and did my graduate work at Boston College. It was while I was living in Boston. I'd moved to Boston. I grew up in California in a Central Valley town called Merced in California in the 80s and 90s. And really had I'd grown up going into the city, occasionally going to San Francisco, mostly, but really only going in for, you know, sporting events or other kinds of shows. And it was, of course, during the 80s where in many ways, kind of anti-urbanism was at its height. And so I grew up in this culture that was extremely fearful of cities, extremely suspicious about the kinds of interactions that took place in cities. And it was only when I moved to Boston and in the late, kind of at the very end of the 1990s and really the first decade of the 21st century, as I interacted with people in the city, I felt a kind of connection, a kind of affection for people in the city that I just didn't have the language to articulate. You know, my culture, in other words, hadn't given me the words or the concepts with which I could make sense of the types of emotions and affections that I felt for people with whom I rode the subway, people I encountered on the sidewalk. And so really the project grew out of that. I wanted to try to make sense of, I wanted to try to figure out if others had developed this language for trying to make sense of cities and more specifically the kinds of interactions and affiliations that people formed in cities. Because my culture, I didn't feel had given me the words with which I could do that.
Now, what is it about urban environments that are different, let's say, from a small town or rural mm-hmm. America? What makes it unique, and why is there a problem with language regarding what was happening socially right. in a city? Can you give me a very general question, because I've got more specific ones later.
Yeah, no, of course. Yeah, I mean, I think that I talk about this in the book a little bit, the transition from a language or a discourse of sympathy to one of sociability, which is where the title of the book comes from, The Sociable City. I think that the language of sympathy, although it might not kind of accurately account for the kinds of relationships that occur in smaller towns, I think that for the most part, we still in smaller towns insist upon the logic of sympathy. The language and logic of sympathy. But in the city, because you're encountering so many strangers, people that you can't pretend to have, in my experience, any kind of intimacy with, you know, you'd see people on the subway and never see them again. You would you know, you might run into people in your kind of urban neighborhood on the sidewalk more than once. But even then, you might not necessarily feel any kind of friendship or kinship for them, but you might still feel affection for them, even though they're strangers. And so I think the city really, really forced me to confront the inadequacy of the language of sympathy, which I had used growing up in a smaller town in the Central Valley of California to make sense of my relationships there, right? It was easy to imagine that I could be friends with most of the people that I encountered. Whereas in the city, I just could no longer pretend that because of the sheer number of strangers, the lack of repeated contact. And yet, again, I still felt some kind of connection, some kind of affection for people that I knew I would never see again. I felt connected to them in some way because we shared the same space, we used the same paths. And so I think that's what really makes the language of and logic of sympathy inadequate for urban relationships is just the sheer number of strangers that one encounters.
Most people today now in America, I think it's over 50% for sure. I don't know if it's up to 60% of Americans live in urban environments.
Right.
And most of the people that we encounter in our life that we see are going to be strangers.
Right.
You know, most of us are not dealing. In a day, you're going to see more strangers than you're going to see people that you're intimately engaged with.
Right.
So I thought all this was very interesting. But I want to go back to in your book. At the beginning of the book, you talk about Frederick Law Olson and how can you talk about who he was? Well, I know he was an architect. How did he view cities and how did he try? Who was he and what was he trying to do? He had his particular view about cities.
Right, yeah. So Frederick Law Olmsted is really the father of landscape architecture in our country. Most people will be familiar, if not with him, with his kind of product through places like Central Park in New York City. He also designed the Emerald Necklace in Boston, so places like the Fenway and areas like that. I mean, he designed parks all over the country, and then his son kind of inherited the business and continued to kind of carry out his father's vision, and they just again, like I said, that their reach extended throughout the country. It wasn't just limited to the Northeast or northeastern cities. Really, they planned an amazing number of parks, and I'm interested in Frederick Law Olmsted in this book primarily because of the way that he thought about urban relationships and the way that he responded to those relationships by altering the urban environment. So Frederick Law Olmsted was really suspicious about or anxious about the quality of the quality of the interactions among urbanites on congested urban streets. So of course he was working in the mid-19th century. Cities were still primarily walking cities. You know, people got around the city to and from work on foot. And so as city sidewalks became more and more congested, he worried more and more about the ability of city dwellers to engage sympathetically with each other. He worried that instead of engaging sympathetically with each other, they would be really cautious of each other, kind of judging or sizing up, you know, other pedestrians in relationship to themselves in terms of the danger or the obstacle that they posed to them. And so this made him really anxious. He was worried about the social consequences of those congested sidewalks. So he built parks, places like Central Park, Prospect Park in Brooklyn. He built those parks as an attempt to give urbanites, or basically to remove urbanites from the streets, from these congested streets, and place them in much less congested spaces where they could continue or they could return to engaging with each other in sympathetic ways, where people could have opportunities to form those kind of gentler, more intimate feelings for one another, those connections for one another. And it's, you know, if you walk through Central Park, you know, one of the designs that you'll notice is kind of lots of nooks, secluded nooks and crannies where, you know, families or small gatherings could kind of get away from the street, get away from even other people in the park, and have their, you know, engage with each other in these kind of intimate and sympathetic ways. And so he was, you know, in a sense, his parks, although they're public, of course, you know, it might be helpful to think of them really more as an extension of, say, the parlor or, you know, some kind of domestic space is how he designed them.
Because when we think about Central Park, most of us think in terms of nature, of him wanting to bring nature to the city and the importance of nature for a lot of different reasons. But you're putting focus on the sociability factor and what, you know, what social relationships are occurring in the park. Now, what did you mean by sympathy? Because one of the things that you talk about in your book is familial intimacy, the idea that the family and the kinds of relationships that happen in the family were sort of the idealized standard for how we should all be interacting with each other.
Right. Yeah. And that's, you know, that grows out of the culture of the 18th and 19th century, where, again, this idea of sympathy became the gold standard by which every relationship would be measured. And of course, as you've just said, sympathy in the 18th and 19th centuries signified these kinds of intimate, familial, kinship kinds of relationships. And lots of social thinkers like Olmsted really thought that it was possible for that kind of intimacy to be reproduced among people that weren't related by family ties or through kinship. But they wanted people to feel as if they were family. And, you know, so for example, if you think about the abolitionist movement of the mid-19th century, this is the model upon which they operated, that they were trying to get, you know, white Northerners to feel the kinds of feelings for Southern slaves that mothers and children had for each other. So you'll often see in texts like Uncle Tom's Cabin, kind of the dramatization of, you know, a mother-child relationship that is kind of threatened or severed in an attempt to get white Northern mothers to feel for black Southern slave mothers that kind of intimate bond of kind of mother to child or mother to mother. You know how it feels to be that.
Well, what's interesting about the whole concept of sympathy here is that we think about it even very differently. Even the most sophisticated of us who talk about sympathy in history and being sympathetic to our subjects, it's very different from what you're talking about. We don't, the idea that you would think that every relationship was to, you know, to mimic or some way reflect familial intimacy is rather strange to us. Now, this brings up another point, the whole idea that in 19th century cities were, this is the first time in the 19th century we begin to delineate private space from private space. And I'm thinking about the medieval city, how the medieval cities, that wasn't such a strong line there. You know, the private spaces opened up to public spaces.
Right.
And so can you talk a little bit about how we define public and private spaces?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that you're right. There certainly was a contest, especially in the not a contest, but there was contestation over that delineation between private and public spaces within the city. I think really as industrialization started to reshape the city. So, you know, industrialization was seen as a potential threat to domestic values, domestic relationships. And so you have in the the second half of the 19th century, a real attempt, a real focus to preserve these private spaces and the values, the kind of morals that those domestic spaces were seen to shelter. Those became increasingly closed off to, there was an attempt to increasingly close those off to the kind of public industrial space that was seen as a much more masculine, a much less kind of morally clear or ethical business practices. And so you had the space that, say, you know, people working in the industrial sphere would return to and would kind of recuperate in the domestic space, regain their moral values or reaffirm their moral values before they headed out again to work and then came back. And so I think it's really the industrial city where we see that, that real kind of marked delineation between the public and the private sphere.
Right. But at the same time, though, you've got these social thinkers who are wanting to make that public space in a way, because that private public-private division was very gendered. And
right.
It's like these social thinkers are trying to make the street, the public area, more feminine in a way. It's rather strange.
Right.
Okay, so let me
go. You certainly had movements, kind of the metropolitan housekeeping movement, where, yeah, it's this kind of attempt of kind of women to tame the streets in a sense, or to take care of the streets. And yeah, so there is lots of interesting ways in which those kind of the gendering of the public and the private kind of bleed into each other or break down in some way.
Okay, now we get to the progressive era, and you talk about the progressives, that particularly the people who are involved in these like Hull House, settlement houses.
Settlement houses.
Yes. So can you talk a little bit about what was the concern of progressive era intellectuals, particularly the ones that were involved in settlement houses, regarding the city and what they were trying to do with those mm-hmm. relationships?
Yeah. Yeah. So the settlement house movement grew out of the concern for just the masses of immigrants that were coming into U.S. cities at the end of the 19th century and into the 20th, early stages of the 20th century. And so settlement house workers saw a need to help these immigrants make their homes in these new cities, to assimilate, to receive social services and so forth. I'm most interested in the settlement house movement for the way that it tried to reframe the 19th century version of thinking about urban relationships. And they were really interested in, I think, pushing sympathy, pushing the way that people traditionally thought of sympathetic relationships beyond where people traditionally thought it, how people had traditionally thought about sympathetic relationships. They were interested in, the kind of less intimate relationships. You know, they acknowledged sympathy's traditional inadequacy for accounting for these relationships, and they wanted to push sympathy into what Jane Addams describes as new channels. Right? We need to discover our new channels for sympathy to flow. We need to think about what she described as a cosmopolitan affection, a term that I really like. You know, I'm really interested in the way that they really try to account for the wider variety of relationships that people formed in cities. And they, in particular, were forming these relationships as they interacted with these immigrant communities and individuals in the public sphere.
It's almost like what I noticed, because of the structures of these these settlement houses, they sort of expanded the walls of the settlement house to almost allow for more people to come in to the home.
Yeah.
Semi-private, these places that were not necessarily public spaces, they weren't private spaces, there were these intermediate.
Yeah.
I think that was very interesting. Talk about that and how they did that.
Yeah, so I mean, Hull House is the most famous settlement house, but it's a really good example of this use of space that you're talking about. So despite the name house, these houses oftentimes, these settlement homes oftentimes started out as individual homes, but then they literally spatially expanded to cover, in the case of settlement house, you know, an entire city block, nearly. And, the settlement home would include, a cafe or a playground, spaces for theater productions, spaces for all sorts of clubs, to form, right? So, these spaces that were, you know, had been traditionally or in the past domestic and private were now these kind of semi-public spaces, or even sometimes they would operate within the same day as private and public, right? A dining room could be, in the morning private, but later on be transformed in some way through the rearrangement of chairs or other furniture would become public or semi-public spaces, where, again, people could have the settlement house workers could engage with people from the street in ways that were not always carefully plotted out and planned out. And, there's this chance to really, again, expand the type of affection that they had for one another.
And they kind of began to use term friend.
Yes. Yes. So friend became one of the key terms to signify that relationship. As the settlement house progressed in the early stages of the settlement house movement, kind of this idea of brotherhood was the key term that they tried to use, but they quickly realized that, we're not after recreating a kind of intimate familial relationship with these immigrant neighbors of ours. Something else like friendship actually better captures the type of relationship that we are trying to cultivate and are cultivating as we interact with people in these semi-public spaces of the settlement house and as they would enter into the homes of the immigrant families that live nearby.
Okay, how did this, one thing that you talk about in your book is the relationship of the settlement houses to the issue of race.
Yeah.
And how they negotiated or did not negotiate that. And then you bring in W.E. Du Bois and his view about, he illuminated structural racism, that these races are not going to mix if they're structurally sort of segregated in some way. They're not naturally coming together.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, there have been a lot of legitimate criticisms of the settlement movement's inability to cross racial lines. That a lot of settlement houses were set up in neighborhoods that were predominantly full of European immigrants. And there's, again, people document accurately the ways in which many settlement house movements turn their back to the African-American communities in the cities in which they were situated. But nevertheless, Du Bois, I think, really saw the potential for the settlement movement to overcome this racial divide because of its emphasis on spatial proximity. One of the core values of the settlement movement was daily contact. And this idea of this spatial, having a group of upper class white people move into a space of lower class immigrant people and then having daily contact with them, he found that kind of that emphasis upon daily contact really valuable. And he, in the early stages of his career as a sociologist, he lived and worked in a settlement house in Philadelphia and really saw, I think, the possibility for racial integration through the settlement house's social and spatial ideals. And so he used what we might describe as the settlement house's social strategies, spatial strategies, to try to propose a way for kind of broader racial integration, broader attempts to kind of fulfill the dreams and ambitions of Reconstruction in a kind of post-Reconstruction era.
Okay, now after this, you go into the whole interwar years and the New Deal urbanism, where sympathy contracted.
Right.
Well, the idea, the progressives tried to expand it, but then it contracted.
Right.
But we're still using the family ideal as sort of the baseline.
Right.
Okay, so how was that? Talk about how there was a contraction and how this was reflected in the built environment.
Yeah, so exactly as you said. I mean, I think that what I see the settlement house doing is trying to push and expand the conceptual possibilities of sympathy. They wanted sympathy to be a concept that could account for a broader range of fellow feeling among city dwellers. And I think, again, I really liked what they were doing. I thought it was a brave effort, so to speak. But in the 1920s and 30s, as the city faces a different set of challenges, among which were kind of crumbling infrastructure and unaffordable housing, these were seen primarily, or among other threats that crumbling infrastructure and unaffordable housing posed, was to kind of what people saw as the family structure. And so you have the return of a very conventional understanding of sympathy, family, intimacy, and relationships as a way to talk about the threat that that crumbling infrastructure and unaffordable housing has, right? If a family can't afford a home in the city, what will happen to the relationships among them? And in response to these historical conditions, you have the rise of the public housing movement, which really embraced the kind of contracting conventional understanding of sympathy that in the book I talk about had been really cultivated by urban sociologists, housing, not necessarily public housing advocates, but just people who are interested in the idea of housing. You have them really pushing the value of these kind of intimate kinship type relationships. And so public housing advocates saw sympathy as a kind of handy term that they could use to advocate the public housing movement. They saw this idea of building adequate housing and affordable housing for everybody as a way to return sympathy to both the family, to both families and to people that are unrelated but could interact with each other in more sympathetic, kind of privatized spaces.
Now, then you talk about, that was a Chicago sociologist that you're talking about there.
Yeah.
And then we go to Clarence Perry, who developed an idea of the neighborhood unit, mm-hmm. which had, I thought this was very interesting because it really had an effect on how we think about how neighborhoods were thought
about. Yeah, and how we continue to think about it. Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Okay. And they're very homogeneous. His idea was very homogeneous, uh-huh. right?
Right. Yeah. And again, you have all of these people. So Clarence Perry, who's a really important figure in neighborhood planning, the Chicago sociologist, all of these people are citing Adam Smith, who is the original, so to speak, formulator of sympathy as, you know, the fellow feeling that arises as you imagine yourself in the place of another individual. And cities for Olmsted and Perry, you know, for this kind of long line of thinkers, cities were a threat to that because if you have to imagine yourself in the place of, you know, someone who doesn't speak the same language as you, someone who doesn't share the same culture as you, someone who is economically radically, you know, in a radically different class from you, how do you imagine yourself in their place so that you can generate those fellow feelings? And so someone like Clarence Perry comes along and says, well, we can arrive at sympathy a lot more easily and readily if we just have people that belong to the same class and culture next to each other. And so, yeah, his neighborhood union is really predicated on this idea that sympathy is much easier to achieve among a homogenous group of people.
Right. So they figured if you get everybody sort of alike in their neighborhood, then they all can kind of interact with each other It's easier to identify and have sympathy for somebody that looks like you and is like you than someone who's completely different.
Yeah, but it's not just, and again, I think here's where the contraction of sympathy comes in. It's not just easier to have sympathy in a kind of identify with way, but it's much easier to imagine that, you know, someone who's much like you is a brother or sister, right? So that's where the kind of familial intimacy really returns to the discourse of sympathy. And as I argue in the book, you know, essentially this really marks the kind of exhaustion of sympathy as a possibility for making sense of just the wide range of affiliations that urbanites enter into in the city, right? That I see this public housing movement and the kind of adoption of sympathy as their kind of core value as, well, you know, sympathy really can't go anywhere from here. That calls for the need for a really different discourse.
Okay, so you've talked about the sociologists, you talked about the architects, you talk about these people who were urban developers, or I guess, they're housing advocates, public housing advocates. And then you go into talking about literary urbanists, people who are writing about the city. Mm-hmm. And what kinds of, how do they represent the relationships within the city? Can you give me examples? Can you talk a little bit about those writers, the literature, and how they were capturing things that maybe other people didn't notice, but they were writers and they mm-hmm. were observing and they're writing about it? This is before the New Yorker. This is just some of the literary stuff.
Yeah. So I think that what I argue in the book is that at the same time as you have these public housing advocates arguing for the kind of primacy or the you know, they're privileging intimacy and intimate type of sympathy as the social standard, the social gold standard, you have other writers like people who started up at the New Yorker, people like E.B. White, people like Joseph Mitchell and A.J. Liebling. They're trying to capture a very different set of relationships in the city. And the New Yorker really was interested in capturing from its early stages the kind of public life of the city. And so you have people at the New Yorker really trying to develop ways of talking about that public life, ways of talking about what happens on the streets of a city, what happens in commercial spaces, what happens, and increasingly what happens there that's of value as these places start to be torn down and redeveloped. And so the New Yorker writers are cultivating this discourse of sociability. They're not interested in the kinds of intimate relationships that people might experience among close friends in the city or within families. They're interested in really capturing the affections that occur within a kind of larger neighborhood or within, these spontaneous public interactions. You know, I mark them as the kind of beginning of the emergence of this discourse of sociability.
Now they're doing urban profiles or going and like doing a profile of a street or a small neighborhood or a gathering place or particular characters in the city. Maybe the grocer or somebody like that. And how he's talking to the customers and who the people are that come in and out. And so they're doing almost like a sociological study on a very micro basis, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a great way to think about it. So they're interested in the social possibilities that the commercial infrastructure of a city makes possible. That they're interested in exactly as you're describing. You know, what happens? We have all these this wide variety of kind of professions or ways of making a living in the city that bring people into contact with each other. But again, if we go back to the 19th century. Kind of culture of really trying to separate, the public sphere from the private sphere so that you keep kind of certain domestic values and social values protected in the domestic sphere. Here we have the New Yorker writers really trying to figure out, well, what happens? How do we explain the emotional ties that inevitably arise between customers and proprietors and, as someone's out and about in the city making a living, they inevitably bump into and encounter people that are not going to be close friends or that they're not going to view as brothers or sisters. And yet there's something that, that the New York was trying to, New Yorker writers are trying to nevertheless assign value to those relationships and trying to come up with language. And so they weren't dealing in these kind of grandiose kind of emotional terms or affections like intimacy, love, but they're instead dealing in cooperation or, you know, much less kind of grand affections.
Yeah, but there is actually, you know, in the city, they observed that there were actually rules. There are rules for public engagement, you know, manners, you know, whether you look somebody in the eye or you don't, you know, how do you, you know, whether you touch people, you don't touch people. There's some, I mean, I've no, you know, if you go to some place like New York where it's really, really crowded, there are rules about how you navigate the crowd and how you talk to people in the street if you need to talk to somebody on the street. So so that's undergirded, the rules are undergirded by certain kinds of human values, I would think.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that, again, those rules that you're describing, I mean, many would interpret that as evidence of the kind of social coldness of the city or the heartlessness of urban dwellers. And again, I think people like the early New Yorker writers were saying, no, it's not necessarily social coldness. There's a real affection here that binds these urbanites to one another. It's just not sympathy. It's just not intimacy. It's something else.
Right.
And again, that became that something else is the thing that they tried to put in words, and that people like Betty Smith, who wrote Tree Grows in Brooklyn, tried to put into words. You know, you have these writers trying to do what I was trying to do when I moved to the city. I don't have a language for, my culture hasn't given me a language for making sense of and kind of assigning value to these relationships that clearly aren't intimate, clearly aren't sympathetic in the traditional sense of the word. So what are they?
Yeah, they may not be your friends, but they're not strangers either.
Right.
Especially if you see them, you know, on a regular basis on the street. They're not your friends, they're not your family, but there's something to you.
Right. Yeah. And again, I think increasingly as the urban renewal order emerged, the threat of urban renewal, of this kind of widespread and heavily funded from federal government kind of destruction of the city or certain parts of the city, you know, entire neighborhoods, sometimes to create civic centers or highways, you know, that threat to these spaces, commercial spaces, sidewalks, other public spaces where those relationships were rooted, became kind of put increasing pressure upon people like the New Yorker writers or tenement dwellers to try to develop a more robust discourse for explaining the value of these relationships, which traditionally hadn't had any value assigned to them.
It's almost like they're trying to account for the millions of micro relationships that are happening every day. They're little micro seconds of interaction that build up to make a neighborhood or to make a city.
Right, exactly. And how do you defend that? You know, it's easy to defend a family. You know, this will destroy families if you do this. But yeah, how do you defend all those millions, as you're describing, you know, micro relationships? And so, yeah, that's, you know, in a sense, that's the pressure, that's the kind of historical pressure under which the discourse of urban sociability emerged.
Well, there was something that was surprising to me, that was new to me, was, you know, I've heard of the term urban ecology, but I never thought about where it came from. I never thought that it came from, you know, ecologist of nature, the ecology of nature. And then, so you have this chapter where you talk about Rachel Carson and how the scientific language of ecology in the natural world gets translated into a community ecology, a human community. And Rachel Carson was published in the New Yorker, and people were kind of wondering why she was published in the New Yorker, because she was talking about ecology of nature, right?
Right.
And New Yorker had a reputation for writing about urban relationships. So this jump here is fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I see Rachel Carson's placement in the New Yorker in the 1950s as evidence of the overlap or the resonance between the kind of work that early New Yorker writers were trying to do, like Joseph Mitchell and A.J. Liebling, E.B. White, and this emerging discourse of ecology. In a sense, what I see happening there is that Rachel Carson's ecological sensibilities, her ways of making sense of the interrelationships among creatures, organisms within an ecological system or within an ecological habitat, really resonated with what the New Yorker writers have been trying to do in terms of explaining the interrelationships among the thousands of people that might inhabit a neighborhood or a city. But even more than that, not only did it resonate, I think ecology really took the discourse of sociability, urban sociability, to a level that it was trying to get to but couldn't quite get to. It gave it the language, the gloss. It gave it a new glossary for trying to make sense of not just people, not just the people that you might interact with kind of physically in a city, but the people to whom you're connected that you never see at all. Right. So it caught in an ecological habitat, a kind of in the natural world. You have ecologists trying to argue that, well, this organism is connected to this organism. What happens to this organism here will directly affect an organism that, that organism might never see or never, they might never interact. But if you remove that organism, something catastrophic might happen. And you'll offset or you'll destabilize the ecological balance. So this idea of balance became really important for mid-century ecologists. And urbanists found that to be really appealing, a really appealing way to make sense of the interconnections that people had with one another in a city, even if they never physically interacted with each other.
Right, like you always think that you can turn the tap on in the city and the water's going to come out. And there's, thousands of people behind that tap who are making that happen. Or the garbage man comes by and picks up your trash. You never see the guy or the woman. But your trash gets picked up.
Right.
It's somebody's doing it, but you don't know who they are.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't know who they are. But that doesn't mean that you can't feel some kind of fellow feeling for them. Right. You know, there's a way in which ecology allowed urbanists interested in trying to make sense of these, again, all these thousands of interconnections among urbanites, some social and effective heft and weight, that it would be, it'd be possible to feel fellow feeling for the garbage man that you never see, because of, again, just ecology gave them that ability to talk about it in those terms.
So it's really about interdependence, the language of interdependence, like in nature. And so it not only interdependence between human beings with each other, but also with the built environment. The built environment shapes also those relationships.
Right.
So it's a whole ecological, the streets, everything. It's the whole, and seeing those as a total urban ecological system.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, again, we're dealing at this moment in time with really the full blown version of urban renewal, where, in the post-war years, you have the federal government giving cities millions and millions of dollars to rebuild cities to retrofit them for the automobile, to retrofit them for a new type of economy. And again, what you have is cities with that federal funding really wiping out entire neighborhoods, really destroying social ecology, as well as the kind of ecology that you're describing of the built environment, the humans, and people were saying, wait a minute. Now, before we go and do all this, let's just hold up and think about the implications of that destruction. And ecology happened to be a really handy tool for making that counter argument to the logic of urban renewal.
Because urban renewal had the assumption that the relationships in cities, those more casual secondary relationships, really didn't matter.
Didn't matter, exactly.
That, you know, okay, we'll just, you can wipe it out and you can start over and some new ones will come along. And, you know, what matters is that providing people with a good, adequate private spaces.
Right, exactly. Yep, totally. Okay.
So then you have Jane Jacobs, who we know a lot about her, but she begins to say, okay, these casual secondary relationships are really important,
right?
And it should affect how we build our cities and what we do with the ones we've already have.
Right.
Okay. Can you talk about what are her some of the things that she wanted to encourage and some things that she was trying to discourage that she thought was going to contribute to better human relations?
Yeah. Yeah. So I see Jane Jacobs as someone who a lot of people see Jane Jacobs as the beginning point of this new way of thinking about cities. Someone who argued that, the street was valuable, that having eyes on the street is what makes cities safe, or that, in terms of her more kind of planning propositions, that, you know, generally shorter blocks are better because it gives people more opportunities to interact, more people opportunities to kind of take different routes and again, see different people. I see her actually as solidifying this much longer tradition of urban sociability and to some degree sympathy that I've kind of traced throughout this book. So Jane Jacobs was, very much educated in the kind of history of the Settlement House movement. You know, she volunteered for and sat on the board and did work for Union Settlement House in New York City. She was a journalist in the 1930s for magazines like Vogue. She wrote pieces for Vogue magazine, pieces that really could have just as easily been placed in the New Yorker. The way that she was describing the Flower District or the Diamond District or, you know, these different interactions of people in these economic kind of districts as they dickered with each other, kind of bantered back and forth. You know, she was trying to make sense of, just like the New Yorker writers were the kind of social value of those interactions. She was very much trained in the kind of discipline of ecology. She was very much interested in science and sites, some of these mid-century ecologists and urban ecologists. So I see her as bringing this longer tradition of trying to make sense of this range of urban relationships, public urban relationships, and packaging it in such a way that it really had the sense of a cultural discourse, a kind of cultural tradition. And she popularized that discourse. So she's saying in many ways the things that a lot of people before her had been saying already, but she's saying them in such a way that people really grasp what she's talking about.
Now, it seems to me that this whole sociability thing is really, and using the ecological system as sort of a way to describe it, is really about encouraging diversity. It's almost saying the more diverse it is, the better it's going to be, right?
Yep.
Which we hear this all the time, right?
Right.
And that's great, but the thing is, why do we have so much suburban, the spread that we've had in our major cities where you've got these suburbs that are like all the houses all look alike and it looks like everybody in them is just alike, and it's changing rapidly now, but, there was another movement going on too, apparently, that was continuing to do things that were not really the best for creating sociable cities.
Right.
So, you know, they call it the bedroom suburbs, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you have, I mean, one might see the counterpart to urban renewal as white flight. The government was not only funding the kind of destruction and rebuilding of cities, but they were simultaneously funding suburbanization. They were paying for highways that led out to suburban spaces. They were, you know, subsidizing the loans that people got to build and buy these houses. And so, I mean, I think that Jacobs is someone who comes in and sees all this happening and attempts to say essentially that we're missing out if we don't think about the validity of these alternative types of relationships. I mean, one might see suburbanization is really driven by the same kind of social ideals that public housing was driven by, the attempt to privilege intimate relationships. Let's get these people out in single family homes and stabilize their kind of domestic relationships, reestablish intimacy away from the city. And Jacobs comes in and says, I don't know if this is such a great idea. I actually really find great value in the kinds of public interactions that I get. And there are many moments in the Death and Life of Great American Cities where she essentially says, I don't want people, I don't want my neighbors in my hair all the time. I don't want them to know my business. I want these kinds of public contacts, or what she refers to as casual contacts. I find those extremely enjoyable. I find people watching extremely satisfying and enjoyable. If I didn't have that, my life would be not quite as vibrant, not quite as meaningful in some pretty significant ways. So she comes in and really champions what those kinds of public social relationships add to one's life. And, she's drawing upon the language of ecology when she talks about mutual interdependence. Anyway, just her language throughout Death and Life is just really interesting in the way that she, again, draws upon this previous tradition to really validate and give assign value to those kinds of public relationships that in the 18th century, for example, 18th and 19th century had been really denigrated or not given any kind of value.
Okay, so I know this is beyond the scope of your book, but where is the urban sociability now? Where does it stand? Do you have any sense of where we are? Are we seeing these, the people trying to do the re-urban core, people moving back to the core? There's all this idea of building these little micro, urban villages that,
yeah,
multi-use, environments.
Yeah, it's really hard to know. You're certainly right. I mean, as a culture, we think much differently about the city. And I think as a culture, we are much more quick to embrace the social possibilities of the city. No longer do we fear urban relationships, urban interactions in the same way that I did when I was growing up in the 80s in Central Valley, California. So I think that, on the one hand, we're much more, as a culture, we're much more open to sociability, or we embrace the value of sociability over intimacy, or in addition to intimacy, much more readily. There are, of course, things I think that Jane Jacobs would not love about kind of our current urban trends. I mean, urban spaces are much less diverse than they used to be. I think that she would not. She would say that the gentrification of cities is in many ways harming the kind of ecological diversity and therefore the structure of feeling that one might have in the city. So I think there's that. But there's also, I think, we continue to innovate the ways that we communicate with and interact with each other. I mean, I think that many people would see things like social media or cell phone use as really diminishing the kind of social vibrancy of urban public spaces. If everyone's looking at their phone instead of looking at each other, doesn't this diminish the kind of sociableness of the city? I think in some ways, it's easy to make that argument, but I think that it's very possible, and I believe that sociability can also occur over social media, right? That social media has ways of connecting and therefore generating forms of fellow feeling that are equally valid, right? That they're different than the forms of fellow feeling that, say, the urban ecologists and Jane Jacobs and the New Yorker writers are trying to kind of trace and narrate. But I see just simply alternative forms of sociability emerging as technologies change, as urban form changes. and so forth.
Okay. Jamin, thank you so much. You've been generous with your time. It's very interesting. Thank you, and thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in American Studies. You can contact me through my website, lillianbarger.com. This is your host, Lillian Barger.